out of joint. We are exhorted to be a body of Christ, fitly joined together. You're familiar with that passage from Ephesians 4. That is the goal, but it is not always or even often the reality. Sometimes we become disjointed, pulled away. People don't always make decisions to join the body. And if they do, they don't always remain faithful in the body. And they become out of joint. Sometimes we become out of joint. The topic that was sent to me from the congregation is, we would like for you to discuss what a Christian's responsibility to unbelieving family members are, or family members who have left the church or have been disfellowshipped. I was talking to Daryl earlier this week, I guess, and he said, that's a hard topic. I offered to trade with him. Didn't happen. I'm not sure it's that hard of a topic. At least in what the Bible tells us to do. I think it is a hard topic in that we're basically unwilling to do it. And we see the consequences of it. I think one of the key factors that destroys, inhibits our ability with unbelieving family members or family members who have fallen away is that we are simply scared to take a risk. We are afraid that we will lose their relationship if we do what God tells us to do in those situations. I believe we value the relationships of this life more than we value the relationships of the next life. I know of no other way to explain the atrocious disregard for God's commandments when it comes to this issue. It's easier, I understand, to talk to a stranger than it is to someone that we know well. Why is that? Because with a stranger, there's no risk. If they never talk to us again, so what? If it's our children or our parents or a brother or a sister or an aunt or an uncle, there's a risk. And 9 times out of 10, I don't believe we're willing to take that risk, even though God tells us to do it. And we've all been faced with that. When I was growing up, Saturday afternoons, ABC, Wild World of Sports, their theme was the joy of victory and the agony of defeat. And that's a risk that we often... I'm kind of glad I don't have a lot of time left because I've got to cut to the chase. And that's probably what I should have planned to do earlier. There's a great joy when a family member comes to the Lord. I was with a Christian lady in the last few weeks who had for quite some time prayed for her parents to come to the Lord. She had talked to them periodically about it. I walked into the assembly and lo and behold, there were her parents. Shortly after that, she walked in with one of the biggest grins you have ever seen. But it doesn't always happen that way. You're not unique, and I'm not unique. Jesus' family was in the exact same boat. He had several brothers and several sisters, and throughout the Gospels, his brothers rejected him, rejected him, rejected him. But when you get to Acts chapter 1, his brothers were there with the disciples praying at his ascension. I don't know what happened. We're not told if Jesus talked to them. But I think we've got a pretty good idea of a few things that happened. Unbelieving family members. Disfellowshipped family members. There are congregations in our brotherhood that don't believe in this fellowship anymore. Have it your way. God does. Not to amputate, but to restore. You know, one of the things we often might say about our current public school systems, and I agree with this, that's why I'm glad I didn't become a teacher. You cannot teach without discipline. I don't care how good you are. You can talk, you can present the material, but you can't teach without discipline. We understand that in our public schools. Why don't we sometimes understand that in our congregations? I simply have three things that I have pulled from scriptures, and I'm sure you could make a longer list. What do we do about unbelieving family members or those that have been disfellowshipped? Well, in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, he gives the wives of unbelieving husbands a good start. Be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without word may be won by the conduct of their wives. And I think that principle applies not only to wives and husbands, it applies to family members. By the example of our conduct. Paul, writing to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 12, counseling Timothy, who wasn't that young at this point. He was probably in his early 40s. He said, however, let no one despise your youth, but now listen to this. Be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, and impurity. And Gerald referenced purity quite eloquently in the latter part of his talk. Till I come, give attention to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Paul said, Timothy, if you want to have any effect as an evangelist, if you want to have any effect in bringing people to the Lord, you be an example in all of these areas. I weary of parents who come and would say something to the effect, I don't understand what happened to our family. 9 times out of 10, I'm tempted to tell them. I don't always. But they didn't have the example that Paul's talking about. They didn't see it in you. They didn't see it in us. If you don't attend the assembly of the Lord's church when it opens its doors, don't be surprised if your children don't either. Period. Not only being an example, I think timing is often very, very important. You know, sometimes it takes a death to bring some loved one to the Lord. Maybe that's what happened with Jesus. I don't know. His brothers went from not believing and rejecting him to being there in Acts 1 and praying with the disciples. And Jesus had died. I don't know if that's what woke them up. Sometimes it takes something traumatic. I'm interested in Proverbs chapter 25, verse 11. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. Fitly means to be something that you can appropriately wheel to the right time, just at the right time. But I'm also interested in that passage that it said a word fitly spoken, not words fitly spoken. Solomon doesn't say give them a lecture. That would be words. He said a word fitly spoken. I really miss you at church. You know, there's only one thing really missing from our relationship. We're no longer brothers and sisters. Maybe someday we'll be able to do that again. Well, I'll grant you, those were more than a word, but they were brief. We have a member at our congregation, a very dear member. He was once an elder in a congregation, and his wife left him, and he drifted away from the church. He's since come back. And I knew him when he was an elder. I knew his first wife, and I was just curious. I asked him one day, "What brought you back?" And I was thinking, well, some evangelist went and pontificated. He said, "No, there was a little lady from the church that happened to shop at the grocery store where I shopped. And every time we ran into each other, she simply said, 'I really miss you.'" A word fitly spoken. What was she going to say to that man that he didn't already know about the plan of salvation? Nothing. That word fitly spoken. We have all kinds of false excuses for not doing this. Someone else could say or do it better. Maybe they could, but that doesn't take you and I off the hook. I'll just mess it up. I'll tell you what'll mess it up, not trying. It may break our relationship. It could. But when has our relationship here on earth become more important than our relationship in eternity? There will be a better time. Maybe there will be, but that doesn't mean this isn't a good time also. That's usually a put-off. Let's be honest with one another. The third one, and I am going to spend a tad more time on this, because I just see it over and over and over, and it will probably offend some of you. We enable other people's sin by the way we choose to interact with them when they're in a sinful situation. Don't enable sinful conduct. "Well, I wouldn't do that." Well, bear with me. Enabling is offering the wrong kind of help. It's often a very selfish thing to do. Enabling tends to cover up a wrong. Enabling is rescuing someone so they don't experience the eternal painful consequences of their irresponsible decisions. Enabling is anything that stands in the way of someone experiencing the now consequences of their own behavior. And there are now consequences. There have to be. If there are no consequences, there's no discipline. I don't care what we tell ourselves. If I tell my children, or if I had told my children, "Don't do this," they did it, and there were no consequences, that's not discipline. Enabling is feeding the problem and working against the work of God in doing that God is doing in someone's lives. Now think about this, brothers and sisters. Do we ever consider first how God might be at work in a person's life before we jump in and do what we think is best? I don't want my child to suffer. I don't want my sister or brother in the flesh to suffer. I don't want to offend Aunt Mildred or Uncle Charlie. Do we try to figure out how to comfort someone when comfort is the last thing they need? I have seen parent after parent try to comfort a sinning child rather than allowing that child to undergo the consequences of their sins in a way that I think God's trying to work in their lives to straighten that person out? Do we try to protect when correction, not protection, is what is needed? Do we think about how the help we offer could be standing in the way of God's plan for restoration? Do we place so much emphasis on our own emotions, guilt, frustrations, and determinations to not lose somebody or their relationship that we forget to consider that our actions may be what's causing them to be lost? There was a lady in southern Iowa. She's dead now. Member of the church. Whenever I would go to that congregation, she would always be there. Nice lady. But there were a few times she wouldn't be there. And I come to find out, if her children came from out of town to visit her that weekend, she wouldn't come. She'd stay home. When the thing those children needed to see was mom at church, because that placed mom's priorities right where mom's priorities ought to be. Enabling someone's sin leads to taking an indirect part in their sin. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 22. When anybody is corrected by the church, and I'm not afraid to use the word disfellowship, it must change our relationship with them. Whether it's me, whether it's you, whether it's my children, whether it's your children, whether it's my parents, whether it's your parents, it doesn't matter. They would still be our physical family, but they are no longer our spiritual family. And there are privileges to being part of the spiritual family that are lost at that moment. If they are not lost, then there are no consequences. And we should not be surprised if God's work's not done. I'm not saying we shun them, but I am saying we can't, in my opinion of scriptures, continue to have the same relationship with them. I have seen parent after parent after parent, knowing that their children have sinned and knowing even that the church has had to take action against them, they continue to have the exact same relationship with them they have always had. Where is the consequences? A very dear friend of mine, maybe one of my five best friends, and that's about all I've got. You're not one of them. I'll tell you when you are. His son, when his son was younger, wasn't a terrible kid, but he had a series of traffic violations, the tickets, that he just didn't deal with. This young man got stopped for a fairly minor, five miles over the speed limit, whatever it was. But when they do, they take your license, they go back, and if they're in a bad mood, they take a half hour, and if they're in a good mood, it might take 15 minutes. They checked their. They saw all these tickets. Next thing this young man knew, he was out of the car, hands behind his back with cufflinks. Handcuffs. He might have had cufflinks, but knowing him, he didn't even have a shirt. They took him to the police department. He was allowed that one phone call. He called his dad, who happened to be a pillar, I'll just say a pillar in the congregation. His dad went down to the police station, and this young man, I'm sure, had great hopes of getting bailed out. He assessed the situation, he looked it over, and he looked at his son and said, "I'll see you tomorrow." He left his son in jail overnight. I think that was one of the greatest acts of love I have ever seen. Was that easy? No. There have to be consequences. And when we rationalize and justify the conduct of our loved ones to make them think it's no big deal, it is the most unloving thing we can do. Because we're saying our relationship with you in this life far supersedes what we want in the next life. Without consequences, change is seldom sought. Rebellion requires discipline, and discipline requires consequences. Adam enabled Eve. Eli enabled his sons, who were very sinful. Samuel enabled his sons, who were very sinful. You know, we often think that the children of Israel wanted a king because they wanted to be like other nations. That was only part of it. I think they wanted a king to make sure Samuel's sons didn't take over. And I'm talking about men of God. High priest, a prophet. Our oldest son, when he was probably about 20, a good friend of his, a friend in the church, was straying from the church. And he decided to move in with his girlfriend. And what got Brandon was the father of this boy, who was a member of the church, helped his son move in. And I never will forget, Brandon kind of looked at me and he grinned and he said, "I bet you wouldn't do that." Fortunately, it was never tested, but it wouldn't have happened. That had somewhat of a happy ending. That boy's back in the church. He's not in Kansas City anymore. He's a deacon in the church. But that's not always that kind of happy ending, is it? Lack of an example, lack of consequences. We are told to admonish and to speak the truth in love. That's very true. I'm not trying to say harshness. I'm talking about firmness for what we believe. I can count in about 60 to 120 seconds the amount of time my dad and I discussed Scripture. I never remember my dad telling me I should do this spiritually. But I always knew exactly where he stood because of his example. And that spoke louder than probably any sermon you've ever heard him give. Some of you have heard more sermons from him than I ever heard. To enable is to embody someone to continue to empower their ability to sin or to take the consequences away from it. There's nothing cute about avoiding the consequences. And there's nothing cute about allowing someone to think they've avoided the consequences. God said, "Whom he loves, he disciplines." You know, I'm going to close here in a minute. Soapbox is long enough. But I think one of the questions that we really come down to is, do we love our families enough to tell them what they need to hear, show them how they need to act, and allow them to suffer the consequences if they ignore it? We all love our families. But do we love them enough? Let's say one of these kids tonight breaks an arm. Could happen. Hope it doesn't. Could happen. We take them to the ER, to the doctor, or wherever, and the doctor says we need to set it. Or if it's dislocated, we need... That hurts. Which one of us is going to say, I don't want you to set my child's arm because it's going to hurt him? We wouldn't say that. Because we know a little bit of hurt now is essential for a lifetime of joy with that limb later. Why would we try to get out of someone feeling some discomfort now if that's what is needed for them to have comfort for eternity? It makes absolutely no sense. Pardon me, it's just mind-boggling. To me. It takes God Himself to convince people to believe. I can't make members of my family believe, and you can't make members of your family believe. We can set an example, we can have a word fitly spoken, and we can use consequences of bad conduct when that happens to try to help them learn a lesson. But only God can turn a sinner into a saint. So I don't think we should necessarily feel guilty when that doesn't happen, because it isn't always going to happen. That's a fact. I do think we should feel shame and guilt when we don't try, when we don't allow them to suffer the consequences. With prayer, allow the Holy Spirit to do His work. Their salvation rests in their willingness to accept God as Lord of their lives. Do all that we can do, but realize you can't do it all. That's God's business. But He does expect us to give an example, words fitly spoken, and don't enable bad conduct by trying to remove the consequences of that bad conduct. Because the lessons will never be learned that way. There were several times in my life when I was growing up that I knew when Dad came home I was going to have to tell him something that I didn't want to tell him. And the reason I didn't want to tell him is that I thought there would be consequences. And sometimes there were. But he loved me enough to see that I endured those consequences. We're going to close our thoughts to extend the gospel invitation. There are consequences to not accepting the Lord. Far worse than a night in jail. Far worse than a switch. If you have young children, enjoy them, because now you can make them do what you want them to. But the day's coming when you won't be able to make them. That's when you pray that you showed them. That's when you pray that you love them enough to allow them to suffer some of the things that maybe you had to suffer to make you the man or the woman you are. And in the church, let us love one another enough. Yes, we encourage one another, but let us love one another enough to let the consequences of sin in God's majestic hand change the life that only He can change. Charles has selected a closing number. There are consequences for not being a child of God. You know that. There are consequences for not doing our part in restoring someone back to the Lord by trying to rationalize those consequences away. Let it never be. If we can help anybody in any way, we invite you to come as we stand and as we sing.